Over time, we get better at understanding mental illness and take perhaps a less judgmental view of the people who suffer from it. We get a longer view of mental illness from the inside in a book called A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, and miraculous is misspelled for reasons we'll get into. Sandy Allen is the author, but Sandy's Uncle Bob is the one who had the experiences and wrote down the original manuscript that forms the backbone of the book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. Sandy Allen is a writer, speaker, editor, and teacher with works published in many places, BuzzFeed and CNN Opinion included. Sandy was BuzzFeed's deputy features editor and founder of the literary quarterly Wags Review. Sandy lives in the Catskill Mountains in New York State. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And Uncle Bob apparently lived in our part of the world. What was his last home?
He did. Yeah, I don't get too specific about where he lived, actually. It's funny. I was thinking about that. I was listening to your weather report. I was like, wow, I'm finally talking to the part of the world where Bob lived.
Indeed.
So I won't get more specific than that. But yeah, he was in Northern California, and he lived rurally, and he was there really from about 1980 to when he passed away a few years ago.
You begin the book with a phone call from Uncle Bob.
Right.
So you knew his voice, but over the, I mean, how well did you know him over the years?
Yeah, I didn't know him all that well. I start the book with this phone call, and I write that he had a really recognizable voice because he kind of had that 1960, he was from Berkeley, and he had come of age during the 60s, early 70s, and he definitely sounded, as I write, stuck there. He said, you know, hey, man, how you doing, man? Far out, you know, a little bit of that. And so it was really always, if you had Uncle Bob on the phone, you knew it. And I hadn't heard from him in years. I didn't even have his cell phone. I mean, I didn't have his number in my cell phone. But I answered it, and it was about 10 years ago. And I, you know, he wanted to mail me something he'd written, and I was a little preoccupied. I had just moved to Iowa to start graduate school in creative writing. And I said, okay, whatever. I gave him my address. I forgot about it. And then a couple of weeks later, this envelope shows up. And at first, I didn't even know what it was. But then I saw the handwriting, and I was like, oh, this is Uncle Bob. And inside was this thing he'd typed on his typewriter. It was his whole life story. It was about 60 pages. It stunk like cigarettes. It was typed in all capital letters, punctuated mostly with colons. It was really inventively spelled, you know, and it was also really clear that it was really honest, you know, really revealing. And so right away I pretty much had no idea what to do with it and set it in a drawer and kind of hoped I wouldn't look at it too much because it sort of seemed kind of dangerous.
So how long did it stay in that drawer before you went back to it, and what got you to go back to it, Sandy?
Yeah, I was starting this degree in creative nonfiction, and so I was doing this thing where I was sitting in these classes and hanging out with my peers at the bars after and debating about how do we draw this line between nonfiction and fiction writing, you know, so that was the rather academic question that I was a little bit interested in, and I would think about Bob's manuscript and what little I'd seen of it, you know, I'd already encountered stuff like there was a part where an energy beam reached down from the heavens and touched him. You know, like I had seen that there was fantastic, or some would say supernatural or science fiction, whatever word we want to use, stuff in it. And so I was thinking about Bob's story in the context of these questions, and I was kind of like, well, if Bob's account of himself doesn't count as nonfiction, that's a pretty boring category. You know, I want a nonfiction that includes Uncle Bob. So I think on some level I was curious what he had written, and I did read it. And honestly, the first time I ever finished it, or, you know, tried to, because it took me years to really figure out how to become fluent in Bob, you know, in terms of the way that he wrote. But even that first time, I remember where I was when I finished reading it. I remember my pulse raced. There was part of me that I think knew, oh, this thing is about to change my whole life, you know, and I think I had some inkling of it even those first moments. And I couldn't have told you what it was. But I think Bob's story had begun to radically shift preconceptions that I had in my mind, in my heart, value judgments that I had made about him or who he was or what kind of person he was. And those were really received stereotypes, you know, that I hadn't really even been too conscious that I carried. But when I listened to Bob's story, when I really tried to take him on his own terms, it really came in like a wave, you know, and it wiped everything clean. And I was like, I'm so much more interested in what Bob had to say about himself than any of the guesses I had about who he was before.
And the preconceived notions go way back. As you pointed out, your mother, his sister, said, oh, you know, Bob's crazy.
Yeah.
And just sort of wrote it off like that. Now, as much as you talk about your heart racing and wanting to tell Bob's story after finally getting through the manuscript, you found plenty in it that was repellent, too. What kinds of things did you see there?
No, and I couldn't have done it back then, you know. I think it was just a private, you know, desire that I had. Oh, I wish everyone could hear this, you know. But back then, I could never have imagined a world in which I would have written a book that actually did that. It seemed absolutely impossible to make anyone interested in, you know, this random guy. And he's, you know, he wrote on the cover of his own story, this is a true story, about being labeled a psychotic paranoid schizophrenic. So he foregrounded, you know, even more specifically than sort of a general term like crazy, he foregrounded the label he'd received in the psychiatric system, which was, you know, schizophrenic. So he was really upfront about that aspect of his story. And a lot of the story, in fact, was about being in the psychiatric system and so forth. But yeah, back then, you know, I really viewed it as something that, you know what, if I have some interest in this, I'll just write it on my own time and no one will ever read it. And that felt safe. So that's where I worked for the first 5 or 6 years of the 8 that I spent writing the book.
Wow. So things obviously picked up speed in the last 3. We'll get into those in a few minutes. The book is called The Kind of Miraculous Paradise. Miraculous spelled M-I-R-R-A-C-U-L-A-S, as Bob spelled it. It is called A True Story About Schizophrenia. It's the work of Sandy Allen. We'll come back and talk more with Sandy and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're getting a story of living with mental illness sort of secondhand on today's exchange. Sandy Allen's uncle Bob wrote up an extensive manuscript, about 60 pages, single-spaced, typed mostly in caps, punctuated mostly with colons, and sent this along to Sandy, and Sandy converted it into a book called A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, M-I-R-R-A-C-U-L-A-S, because Bob's spelling wasn't that good, A True Story About Schizophrenia. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about mental illness, how we deal with it in society, how we view it in other people, how we view it in ourselves if we've experienced it. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Sandy, mentioned already a bit about the typing, and you did too, but there are different typefaces in your book, and one representing his all-caps typing. So do any of his passages appear in the book unedited, I guess is the question?
Yeah, so the book itself is written in 2 fonts, and there's actually sort of 3 modes. One, as you mentioned, is I quote Uncle Bob in all caps. Usually there's colons. I mostly the book is either, you know, my rendition of his story, where I'm also in a sort of typewriter-like font, but it's my prose. And it's the element of the story that is his story. And I've taken it from its original, and I've moved it into my version. And I often like the metaphor of a cover, as in a song, in part because Bob was a rock musician. He was a guitarist. But I think it's a good metaphor for what I've done, because I've taken all of the facts as Bob set them down, and I've really tried to create a world that adheres to his point of view and to everything as he experienced it. But I'm doing so in my own language, and I'm doing so, you know, employing all the stuff that I know how to do, because I'm someone who learned how to write. And, you know, I have that bag of tricks, and I can keep a reader around, you know, long enough to hear the story. But I also did that because, and I described this in the beginning of the book, I encountered a bit of resistance when I tried to just hand people over, you know, a passage from Bob, a paragraph from Bob, even when I was including what I thought were really powerful scenes from him in really early versions of this project. I just found that readers wouldn't even look at them. People wouldn't engage, you know, they wouldn't listen, most of all. They wouldn't feel for, you know, for example, a young man who's been tossed into a cell and injected with an antipsychotic and left there. They weren't reading that because they were really paying attention to stuff like his spellings and the capitals and the colons and stuff. So my cover version is, you know, much the way that like Hendrix at Woodstock plays the national anthem, and it's a completely different song, but we still recognize it, right? So it's got his own spin. My version, you know, I'm really trying to inflect this story with that sort of the way that Bob was and that voice, and that that I also wanted to make the world that he was in feel really full to people. So I've set it in context, and then in a second font, I have me, and I start with the story we started with about getting this thing in the mail, and that's also the area of the book where I'm engaging with some of the bigger questions here, like what is schizophrenia, or how do other people in the family remember all this stuff? You know, what's the truth in this story that Bob's telling, and how does his story intersect with the rest of the world here, with history, with what was going on in Berkeley back then, with the history of mental health and so on. So it's sort of like two stories that are braided together that the reader gets, but it reads like a novel. It reads really fast. That's my favorite thing that readers tell me, is that they read it in a day, they read it in a weekend, they read it in a flight, you know. I really wanted it to be something that would be fun, you know, because Bob's story is, it's an adventure. There's so much that happens to him in the course of his young life.
It does read fast, but you know, one of the things that you mentioned is a key point, which is the difficulty in finding out the truth. I mean, aside from your mother saying, "Well, Uncle Bob's crazy," there wasn't a lot of detail, it sounds like, early in life. So, I mean, how easy was it, or not, later in life, to try to talk to some of these same people, your parents and other relatives, and get some sense from people who didn't really understand what was happening to Bob about Bob?
Yeah. I mean, so my mom was Bob's little sister, and that family had a divorce, and the girls ended up with the mom, and Bob was with his dad. So my mom didn't really live with her brother, you know, at a certain age. You know, she was apart from him, and then he was hospitalized starting in his teens. So her lack of info was sort of reflective of her position in the family, too, and I think also reflective of the fact that, and I don't think my family is unique at all in this respect, there wasn't a lot of conversation, you know, about what's going on with Bob, for example, especially back then. You know, this would have been the kind of stuff that was viewed very shamefully and very would have been cast in a lot of silence, and I'm sure that Bob was made to feel like he was responsible for a lot of stuff that had happened to him that I don't think was his fault, and I don't think it was the fault of his parents, my grandparents, you know, and that's who I was having to approach, was my grandparents, and saying to them, like, here, I've got this book contract, and this is a project that I think is important, and I'd like you to interview with me for it. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, that was a really, really fraught era of this project, you know, because it was a very tricky position that I was putting people in and asking them to participate with this project, with this endeavor, because I said to them, you know, this is a book that's mostly going to be Bob's truth. Like, I'm really turning up the volume on Bob in our conversation around a question like, what is schizophrenia? But I said to them, this is also a story about his parents. It's about his mom and his stepmom and his dad. And it's also a story about his psychiatrist and about how the psychiatric system viewed him. And it's a story about his friends and their accounts of what happened to him and his siblings and his neighbors and so on. So I tried to get everybody, and I did over time. I interviewed really everybody who had something to say, you know, and at a certain point I was well beyond the family. I was finding people from Bob's story and people who'd lived with him in a commune and, you know, the Sierras, and people who had jobs with him back when and were in bands with him. And I was asking them questions, you know, to really try to create, we're seeing Bob's truth in one thread of this book, you know, and then around it we're seeing how everybody else saw him. And I think the real truth about it all is probably somewhere in the middle, you know, and I think that's one of the things that hopefully readers of my book will better understand. You know, I do believe that one of the big problems we have at hand when it comes to having an honest and productive conversation around mental illness is this fractured nature of the way that people understand the situation, and the fact that often people don't know about some big abstract concept called mental health. They know about their kid, you know, who's acting weird or who's done something really embarrassing or horrible. You know, they're thinking about that one individual. And so I think that one of the things that I'm doing in this book, hopefully, is showing the way that there is this multiplicity of realities and truths. And there's also a lot of common ground here. You know, I think that one of the things that was very clear interviewing a lot of people about Bob and about all these events was everybody felt that Bob had been given he had been given an unfair lot. You know, everybody felt that his humanity had been underappreciated and underrecognized by others. Everybody hurt for the ways in which his life had been a lonely one. You know, there were some things that were really true for everyone who knew him well when I interviewed them later on the phone during the last phases of the book, you know, writing process.
Sandy Allen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Sandy took Uncle Bob's manuscript and turned it into a book called A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, A True Story About Schizophrenia. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the implications of this particular case, but more broadly about mental illness and how we think about it and how we deal with it in general. Join us on the Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. It sounds like you got a bit of an education just about family events, about the messy divorce of your grandparents, Bob's parents, his rough time in high school, his drug abuse. I mean, did you know much of this before you had seen the manuscript?
Oh, you know, here and there. But yeah, I mean, I think I really ended up being a rather interesting exercise getting to spend, you know, lots of hours with people and interviewing them about events that were decades old. And in some ways, I mean, especially for certain people in my family, you know, since the book has published, it has been this, it has brought us together in ways that I'm not sure, you know, would have happened otherwise. I think it actually, it did very much change the way my mom and I, you know, spoke to each other. I think sort of going back to some of this stuff, you know, and even that thing I said about her not being that involved, you know, it's like everybody does have all sorts of stuff they know, and it was really interesting to get to talk to people so specifically about someone who, it really turned out a lot of people, I think with Bob particularly, were carrying around a lot of stories and feelings that they hadn't necessarily ever gotten to share with anybody. Bob had been a hermit for his last decades. That was the word he used for himself, but he was very chatty. He loved to talk on the phone, and so he really spent a lot of years there, like forming close connections, especially with cousins of his. And so there were people who knew him really well, you know, a cousin who spoke to him every day on the phone. So when I finally was interviewing her about Bob, you know, it was so interesting because I had really gotten to know him very well, but in a specific way, which was via this manuscript. And by then he was dead. So I was sort of finishing the book without him. And that was it presented its own challenges and made it emotional, I think, for everybody involved. But yeah, I mean, it's really incredible what my family have done. And I think that at the end of the day, they all knew I was sort of there because Bob had, you know, handed it to me. I was really just, I was making good on something because I saw the fact that he was right. I saw the fact that his story was true and it was important and that people should hear it, you know, that there was a value, and this was his line, you know, get the story out there. You know, I agreed there was a value in getting the story out there. And a lot of people in my family agree, too.
You mentioned already some of the historical backdrop here. We're talking Vietnam War, Berkeley in the 60s, baby boom generation, a lot of upheaval in American society at that time. And I got the sense when you talked to your grandfather, Gene, this is Bob's father, you got a good whiff of the 60s generation gap there.
Yeah, that was, you know, something where initially when I read Bob's story, I remember being so struck by how he was really in the thick of it as a teen. He was coming of age. He was at Berkeley High. Berkeley High had integrated, and there was, you know, there was the Bloody Thursday riots on Telegraph. There were the concerts down in Provo Park, and Bob was a guitarist, so he was really interested, you know, in the rock music especially. But yeah, he and his friends, you know, they were cutting school and doing acid and smoking weed and all the stuff you'd imagine, you know, given what was available to a 15, 16-year-old boy back then. And then, yeah, contrast that with his father, who was absolutely of that previous generation, who, you know, really tried to follow rules and did everything right and had been, you know, quite a successful person in his life. And I think that I remember when I first read Bob's story, knowing back then zero about schizophrenia, that was the part of it that I was really interested in. I was like, well, it seems like father and son here are sort of in different cultures, and that must, you know, affect how father is seeing son. And I think that, sure, that's one of the things we do end up thinking a lot about, even as I've become much more educated myself around, you know, issues to do with mental illness and specifically schizophrenia. There's a real big important point there, which is the way that, you know, someone is viewed, for example, by the psychiatric system, you know, has such an effect on his life. So if you have a system who's going to view someone who wears jeans and listens to rock music and has long hair as ill, yeah, sure, you're going to end up casting him as ill. So I remember for a lot of years wondering, you know, was Bob misdiagnosed? Is that really what this story is about?
Well, yeah, we've learned a lot in our separate segment we have with a clubhouse for people who deal with mental illness in Medford about how often the diagnosis is missed and what a difference that can make. There's a great education section in the book that you share with us about your own coming to terms with what happened in American psychiatric care over the years and how we don't warehouse people anymore. John in Grants Pass wants to get on that part of the discussion. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sandy Allen.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I wondered about comments about two things. One is what's called mainstreaming, where apparently in the 70s there was an effort by many hospitals to put people back out in the community, and of course that hasn't worked out great. That's, many of those people are now homeless, and that's my question. Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks, John.
Yeah, I write about deinstitutionalization, which was the kind of Reagan-era term for what this was, which just really means defunding psychiatric hospitals. And this happened a lot in the 70s, 80s, and so Bob is sort of coming up as this is in the air. And a big part of it was, of course, now there was psychiatric pharmaceuticals, and so arguments were made, you know, along the lines of, okay, well, we don't have to keep people in hospitals. They can have their meds. They can live out in the community. And as the caller alluded, like, this was actually quite a big failure. And we're living that now. And, you know, not only in terms of homelessness, where you've got an overrepresentation of people with psychiatric histories, diagnosis of severe mental illness, but also in places like prisons and jails. And if you look at stats to do with, you know, citizens being killed by police, you've got an overrepresentation of people with psychiatric diagnoses, you know, basically vulnerable people being made more vulnerable, which isn't to say that mass institutionalization in the form of psychiatric hospitals was a great answer either. I think that one of the things I'm hopefully doing in this book and in general in my continued work is I think it's really important for us to hear this history. First of all, I don't think many people have ever heard, for example, that, you know, a lot of Americans, for example, are not thinking about the history of the fact that we had state psychiatric hospitals that to the extent that we did, you know, in the 50s at the peak of the system, there were 500,000 people lived in state psychiatric hospitals in this country. And a lot of people have, you know, old abandoned hospitals at the fringes of their town, and they think that their town is special. But no, that's everywhere. We've got old abandoned hospitals. So a point being, we used to fund this, you know. This was a social priority a century before in the mid-19th century. And I write in the book about all this history in part because I just want us to know a little bit more about where we are in this moment and what we are seeing right now. And I think an important point is when you've got more homeless people with these diagnoses and stuff, that also feeds the stereotypes that exist inside the heads of people who aren't, you know, with a diagnosis like that or who aren't homeless. I think it's important that we highlight the fact that this is a situation we bought ourselves. The taxpayers have bought ourselves a psychiatric system that has bought way too much into pharma propaganda and hasn't listened to the wisdom of people who've actually been there. And the good news is, and I think this is part of my project as well, I think we can do better. I think we can do better. And I think we can do it sooner than we think. You know, I think that the tools are already here.
Sandy Hale, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Sandy Allen, rather. The book is A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. Rebecca in Lane County wants to know, what do you do when the person is resistant to help and doesn't believe they have a problem?
Well, I think that's a good question. I really hope you read my book. That would be what I'd say. I think that it's a really common thing that you hear discussed. Oh, people are treatment resistant, or people, you know, they're in denial about what they have or that they need help. And I think that that is something that gets a lot of discussion, right? And there is so much energy around how do you force people into the system. You know, there's so much technological advancement that's all around getting around people's ability to say no. So injectables was one, but now we've got stuff like smart pills where the antipsychotic will literally tell on you if you don't take it. You know, so that sort of innovation, I think, is it has a presumption that, you know, that person's agency needs to be overridden. I really believe it's important for us to pause and begin to figure out how do we listen to those people who are in, you know, in a systemic sense. What would it look like if we really had people with lived experience creating our, you know, quote-unquote mental health care infrastructure? What sort of stuff should we be providing for people who are in crisis? And I don't mean to diminish the question, because I think there is this difference between what I get to do as a writer, you know, sort of reporting and imagining, you know, what could a better way forward be, and the really real practical question of what to do, you know, today if you've got a loved one in crisis. And I really would encourage the caller, the person who wrote in, I've got a website, hellosandyallen.com. If this person is interested, I would recommend read my book, but I've also got a lot of resources there. And a lot of the stuff that I'm promoting is stuff that's thinking about peer support and peer respite and other things that I think are common sense and humane and can appeal to people who, for example, aren't very interested in sort of the mental health care status quo.
HelloSandyAllen.com is that website. Looking right at it. The book is called The Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia written by Sandy Allen using work from Sandy's uncle Bob, who sent this manuscript along and thought Sandy could do something with it, and Sandy certainly did. We'll come back and talk more about the book in just a few moments, and you can join the conversation on The Exchange as we explore mental illness and the way we respond to it as society and as individuals in just a few moments here on The Jefferson Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're exploring mental illness from one person's perspective in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. It actually broadens out to include several people's perspectives, but it all begins with Sandy Allen's Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob dealt with schizophrenia, it appears, for many years and sent Sandy a manuscript where he told his own story in 60 pages with very strange punctuation and capitalization. And Sandy turned it into a book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore attitudes in society and individually about mental illness, inside and out. 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. And emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. I've given short shrift so far to Bob's talents as a musician. How good was he? Did he have a career in music at some point?
You know, that's a great question. I think when I went back and was reading his account of himself, that was one of those things that surprised me, was he was in various bands, and he was, you know, performing and stuff. And I think that I had always known he was a musician. He would send us his cassettes of stuff he'd recorded, or he would play stuff into our answering machine once in a while. And I remember singing songs with him and stuff when I was a kid, because I'm a singer. But yeah, I mean, when I interviewed his friends from high school, people who knew him back then, that was really what they went on and on about, was just how talented of a musician. He was really, I think, an artist, you know, and I identify with that. I think he was someone who was really creative in his sort of orientation toward the world. And so people would recall, like, his mom's house in Berkeley when he was living there in, around his, you know, his 20s and stuff. He'd have the window open and he'd be playing Hendrix and stuff, and the whole neighborhood would be shaking, you know. But yeah, I think he was a really talented person in a lot of senses, and I think he had a lot of qualities that don't come to mind perhaps when we think about, oh, this diagnosis, schizophrenia, and all of the attendant cultural baggage, you know, that a word like that has, or a word like schizophrenic or psycho or, you know, nut or crazy or any of these, you know. I think Bob was someone who was writing his story in part because he sought to talk back, and he sought to really counter a lot of the crap that had been presumed about him through the course of his life, because he was, you know, he had this label, or because he was read as weird, you know, because I think he probably was a really weird dude.
You know, friends from his teen years did provide some insights, as you pointed out. Another guy named Bob remembered Uncle Bob on psychedelics. It's a very interesting description that he gave.
He said they were psychedelic partners. You know, I think that a lot of his friends, it's kind of talking to these guys was, and I'm sure that there's lots of listeners who were there too. You know, you were a teenager, Berkeley back then, late 60s, early 70s, you know, it was all happening. And they were really around it, and I think they were interested in weed and acid for the same reason people are interested in weed and acid still. You know, I think that there is an interest that Bob had for sure in kind of some of the big stuff, big questions, spirituality. I think later in his story, you know, it really becomes a spiritual journey as much as anything else that he's on. And during his latter years when he did live very privately and he called himself a hermit, he meant that in a specifically, you know, Christian sense. He was someone who really found a lot of meaning in Christianity and in faith. And I think in my more recent years as a reporter, as I've interviewed so many people who have had diagnoses like Bob, who've been in the system, who've got lived experience and stuff, it's such a theme. It comes up again and again, you know, that people are really able to find meaning in stuff like spirituality and that can end up being very healing for them.
So how directly in his life did you and Bob ever talk about mental illness or schizophrenia?
No, that's a funny question, and I can't say anyone has ever asked me before, and the answer is not at all.
Wow.
Isn't that funny? I really didn't know him all that well, you know? I wasn't someone who spent hours and hours with him on the phone, I think in part because, I would have been a teenager, you know, in my 20s and stuff. Like, I would have been on my own thing, you know. And Bob sent this to me right as I was, you know, entering kind of into my real adulthood in my 20s. And I think he did catch me. He caught my interest, you know. But I think, if I'm being honest, there's a 50-50 chance I would have tossed it in the trash, you know. It didn't really mean a lot to me when it showed up. I didn't read it and go, oh, this is profound, and I'll spend the next decade of my life on this, you know. That wasn't how I read it at first. I thought, what is this crazy thing from this relative? I don't want to deal with this. And I think the book is as much about my attitude, about that sort of bigotry, that prejudice that I think a lot of us hold toward, you know, people who we hear are crazy or we think are crazy.
So we've got Uncle Bob's friend Bob mentioning something along the lines of, you know, you look into the abyss when you take psychedelics, and Bob had trouble coming back from there. Grandpa Gene wondering if circumstances at home, the messy divorce, that sort of thing might have triggered Bob's illness. Does it work like that? Or, you know, in your research about schizophrenia, did you come up with some different impressions?
You know, here's the long and the short of it. If you go out and you spend years and years, as I did, reading about schizophrenia, reading about psychiatry, the profession that came up with that word and a lot of other words for, you know, the hypothesized ways that brains can be disordered. You know, I read a lot of books, and later I did a lot of interviewing, interviewed psychiatrists and psychologists and geneticists, schizophrenia researchers, and I interviewed people who work in mental health in all kinds of ways and who work in the criminal justice system with people with severe mental illness and people with lived experience. Themselves, people have got family in the system. And I, at a certain point, I had read and learned so much, and I was just more confused than ever. And I think that the long and the short of it is there aren't simple answers. Science doesn't have this one on a lock. It is not a certain that a category like schizophrenia is valid, and it is not necessarily even useful from a diagnostic perspective at this point. In the U.S., a problem we have really specifically in mental health, but I think in health more generally, is we do have such a loud presence of, you know, industry interests. We have such a loud story that's being told to us and fed through our media that starts with pharma, and they really want to sell us a story about, hey, here's this book, and it's got these diagnoses, and some of these people need pills, and these people need these pills, and so on. And I think one of the things that Bob was really fed up with, and a lot of psychiatric patients are really fed up with, was he didn't feel like that diagnosis said anything about him, and he didn't feel like that medication that he was made for his, you know, made to take for his whole life, and he took all kinds of medications and often multiple ones and so on. And that's pretty normal for someone with his diagnosis in that era. And now, you know, he knew what these things were doing to his body and so and his mind. And so that's one of the things that I'm really doing in this book is bringing his opinions on some of this stuff to the fore. Because I think public opinion about this would change if we had more Bob present in our dialogues about these questions of what do these diagnostic categories even refer to and how can we help people who are becoming isolated from others in ways that become concerning.
Let's take a call. Here is Howard in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sandy Allen, who wrote A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. Hi, Howard.
Hi, yes. I have a question about your Uncle Bob. Now, did he have, like, a normal, well-adjusted, happy childhood before this symptoms of schizophrenia showed up, or did he have symptoms of the schizophrenia in his childhood before his teen years? Let me tell you why. I mean, if it turns out he had a well-adjusted, happy childhood, then I could understand where the diagnosis of schizophrenia would come in. But if he had those symptoms in his childhood before his teen years, then maybe he was misdiagnosed with something, and maybe it was a learning disability that was not properly diagnosed.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, no, he had a childhood that it's always going to be what really matters is what it felt like to him, right? If we're thinking about where he ends up in his mind. And I think for him there was a lot of tumult in his world when he was a young person. His folks were divorcing and his society around him, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of tumult, you know, kind of in the culture, and I think he was aware of all that. But, you know, I think there's a good point in this question, and one of the things that I really hope you read the book, because I promise it does get into all that and carefully. I think it's important that we be careful. You know, this diagnosis, schizophrenia, the reason we're talking about it was the one Bob got, you know, and that's really the extent of it. This is not a diagnosis that we are giving to a person with a blood test or a urine test or anything like that. Like, this is a descriptive diagnosis, and it was also the one, you know, it was the version that they were using back then in 1970. So I get into all that and the significance of it. Is it possible that, you know, today, if he were in a different clinician's office, he might have gotten a different diagnosis? Absolutely. Now, the question I'm interested in more is this a valid way? Is this the best way we could be helping people, you know, who we are perceiving as needing help? And the caller referred to symptoms, and I think one of the things that's interesting when I started really trying to root into what was going on with Bob, because from his point of view, he's not writing about anything concerning happening, and then all of a sudden he's in the hospital. You know, that's how he experienced it at age 16. But even the others around him, you know, they weren't saying, oh, well, there was this incident and then that's why he was hospitalized. You know, people didn't even remember. And it was so interesting to me that it really didn't meet that sort of like expectation of what the narrative would be. Oh, we all began observing concerning things and then he went, you know, there was a much more no one was paying attention sort of thing going on. And I think if we're going to be really practical about, you know, what causes, you know, folks to end up in positions where they're getting severe mental illness diagnoses, one of those really good surefire ways is if someone is really isolated. And when I was reading Bob's, you know, story of himself, that's one of the things that was really clear, was he was a really isolated young person. And I think his career in the psychiatric system, at least for the first while, really begat more isolation. And so that's one of those things I want us to begin to think about. You know, if we're imposing solutions on people because we're insisting this is the way of the world and they're saying no and it's hurting them, you know, is that really going to help them if their problem is that they're becoming isolated from other people, or if that's a problem?
And the question about solutions looms large, not only in the book, but in society. And then that makes this phrase jump out. And I'm paraphrasing just a bit here, but you report in the book, Sandy, that no two people I've interviewed felt the same way about what the right treatment should look like.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that part of that is that in general in this space, you know, everyone I talk to usually has something else they want to say. But I think that following that line, I do get to the fact that there are some big stuff that people agree about. And that's, for example, that the system we're paying for right now, which is actually quite expensive, doesn't yield very good results. It does yield pharma profits. It yields profits for other players that are making money off of the system that we have. But I think that one of my general aspirations, you know, both in this project but all of the work to come, you know, knock on wood, is that I'm really hoping to paint us a more interesting imagination of what, quote, mental health care could look like. You know, what could we be buying with our taxpayer dollars? What could we be providing for the likes of Uncle Bob if he's in crisis? But really, for the likes of anybody, because that's one of those facts that you end up learning about mental illness if you read and read about it, is, you know, medicine doesn't have this all figured out, and madness, mental illness, this is something that could affect anybody. You don't really know what's coming inside your mind because you don't really know what's coming inside your world, and so much of these things do happen within people's stories and their experiences of their reality, because of course they do.
Uncle Bob's description of hospitalization in San Francisco sounds rather like a lot of similar descriptions, including One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, for example. And I wonder, as you probed back into Bob's life and talked to people about it, other than using Bob's manuscript, how true were his accounts? Did you come up with a sense for that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, his account of being hospitalized in Berkeley, his first couple of hospitalizations, you know, they sound like cuckoo's nests, maybe, in some respects, but I think they're also just they're stories that, you know, when you've listened to lots of psychiatric patients' stories from that era, for example, they are the stories, you know, that and cuckoo's nest, you know, takes place almost 20 years earlier, but it's showing the same system, that state hospital system, and it's showing a system that's really, really rooted in a patriarchal sort of, you know, we've got folks and white who work, and we've got folks who are the patients, and we've got these diagnoses, and we've got medications, and we've got electroshock, and those are our tools, and that's how we're viewing people. And Bob was in that same system. But in terms of this question of accuracy, one of the real interesting things about finishing his project was I really tried to fact check his story. I had worked in media and newsroom for a few years. Like, I had participated in a zillion fact checks on a lot of stories, so I said, I'm going to fact check Bob's story. And I really laid it all out on my wall, and I tried to just even line up the events, you know, that he described against everybody else's memory and documents and stuff that I had and the events of the day. And the more I looked at it, the more I couldn't believe how accurate his whole thing was. And here he had sat in the desert by himself on his typewriter and written out his whole life story. And the events, they all lined up, you know. There was almost nothing in his original manuscript was I able to say, oh, that definitely is wrong. You know, if anything, I was wrong over and over about all kinds of things I thought would be true.
Well, the book is called A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, A True Story About Schizophrenia. Sandy Allen has turned this into a major project beyond Uncle Bob, with all kinds of resources available through Sandy's website, hellosandyallen.com. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.